Here they come. Right now, they're gathering from hospitals all across America for Talk 10 Tuesday. They know there's important news and information just ahead. Don't miss out. Come in, sit down, and log on. It's Talk 10 Tuesday with Chuck Buck and co-host Dr. Erica Reamer. Here now is the publisher of ICD-10 Monitor, Chuck Buck.
Thank you, Clark Anthony. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the 397th edition of Talk 10 Tuesday, and brought to you today by ICD University. And joining me this morning as my co-host is the very, very popular Dr. Erica Reamer. Dr. Reamer is the founder and the president of Erica Reamer MD Incorporated. And good morning, Erica.
Good morning, Chuck, and good morning, everyone.
In the holiday spirit of giving, this morning we offer free advice how to avoid claim denials. It's a present from Susan Gatehouse.
Susan will be reporting on important steps to take to avoid chronic claim denials.
And speaking of the holiday season, Dr. H. Stephen Moffitt is going to offer some timely advice to keep your stress levels in check. You know, the holiday season is one of those times that tend to bring on stress, anxiety, and among some folks, depression.
Speaking of stress levels, Stanley Nachumson returns with his Reg Watch segment.
I knew you were going to say that. That's right. There's a lot of stress associated with those final rules for 2020. But, of course, there's never any stress with Stanley.
No, there's never any stress with Stanley.
Senior healthcare consultant Lori Johnson has a Talk 10 Tuesday coding report. And you have a talk back segment this morning, and I'm really looking forward to what you have to say about sepsis and the state of New York.
Yes, I'm going to address the issue that New Yorkers have with adopting sepsis 3.
We have much news to report, and we begin this morning with Tim Powell, who's at the Talk 10 Tuesday News Desk.
The Talk 10 Tuesday News Desk is sponsored by ICD University, inviting you to tomorrow's webcast by Stanley Nachumson on the physician payments for 2020.
Here now is Tim Powell.
Thanks, Chuck, and happy holidays, and update your EMS and review your procedures. New Medicare regulations effective January 1st, 2020, per the CMS news release, reads as follows. To reduce burden, we are finalizing broad modifications to documentation policy so that physicians, physician assistants, and advanced practice registered nurses, APRNs, nurse practitioners, clinical nurse specialists, certified nurse midwives and certified registered nurse anesthetists can review and verify, sign, and date, rather than documenting notes made in medical records by other physicians, residents, medical physician assistants, APRN students, nurses, and other members of the medical team. The real rub will come in the implementation. Physicians and physician groups will have to modify their electronic medical records to allow for electronic signing and dating of medical records. The new regulations do not mean that all requirements for documentation are eliminated. Healthcare professionals will need to make sure that the underlying note supports all the elements required for billing. They will also have to try to make sure that the notes are made by medical professionals that are competent to make and enter the note in the first place. I am particularly thinking of notes made by interns and residents that are working on elective rotations. The reason the resident is working in the physician's office is to increase their level of competence. It would seem reasonable that residents and other medical staff are competent to take patients' histories, but what about review of symptoms? I think of concern are the things that patients share with their physician based on personal and the trusting relationship they have created. Finally, since most EMRs drive both documentation and billing and usually suggest billing levels for the physician, is the software used by the physician and other professionals designed to make sure that the signing and dating of medical records is detailed enough to support proper billing under the Medicare program? As an example, a comprehensive examination must include at least 9 organ system or body areas. For each system selected, all the elements of the examination identified by a bullet should be performed unless specific directions limit the content of the examination. For each area, system, documentation of at least 2 elements must be identified by the bullet and is expected. In signing and dating the notes of other professionals, it will be necessary to make sure that the notes of the other professionals are complete, and signing and dating the note may require that each element required may also be signed and dated. I think all professionals billing Medicare need to do some homework over the holidays. Bah humbug, and with that, back to you, Chuck.
Thanks, Tim. That was Tim Powell. Tim is a compliance expert and an ICD-10 Monitor National Correspondent. This is Tuesday. It's December the 10th, and you're listening to the 397th live edition of Talk 10 Tuesday. Stand by.
Big changes are coming to the 2020 Medicare Physician Fee Schedule and Quality Payment Program Final Rule. Significant changes. To to physician documentation requirements, coverage and coding of telehealth services, care management services, roles of physician assistants, and other changes to payment and quality reporting. Learn more during tomorrow's timely webcast at 1:30 p.m. Eastern. Former CMS career professional Stanley Nockamson will talk you through all the changes, and that's important because these new coverage and coding guidelines will require understanding and training so that providers get paid appropriately. Join us tomorrow for 2020 Medicare Physician Payments and Quality Program Final Rule, New Rules and Challenges. To register, use the upcoming webcast tab in today's broadcast. Save $30 when you enter the coupon code Tuesday.
Here now is Senior Healthcare Consultant Lori Johnson with the Talk 10 Tuesday Coding Report. Lori, good morning.
Good morning, Chuck, and good morning, Erica, and hello to our listeners. The holidays are times for people to connect with loved ones, including family and friends. I would ask that during this holiday season, please look out for our adolescents. In October 2019, Public Broadcasting Systems, PBS, published an article that suicide is the second highest reason for death among age range 15 to 24. There is no gender or ethnicity that has been spared the high rate of suicide among this age range. In the general population, suicide is the 10th highest reason for death. It is thought that suicide is contributing to the U.S. life expectancy dropping. I also believe that if we capture the social determinants of health, that we may be able to get this population the appropriate care on a timely basis. Remember that the social determinants of health can be found in Z55 to Z65 in the ICD-10 CM codes. The manner of suicide is coded using the external cause and morbidity codes. As we begin to compose our New Year's resolutions, we should consider our preventive medicine. It is time to get the flu shot if you have procrastinated, which is coded as Z23. Influenza incidence has been rising over the last 4 weeks. This year, influenza B, or Victoria, is the most prevalent, followed by A, H1N1, PDM09. The flu was the reason for 3.5% of healthcare visits last week. The flu vaccine can be life-saving for children and protect pregnant women, as well as reducing the severity of illness. The total pediatric deaths for the current flu season is 6. Screening mammograms are considerations as we begin to think about the new year. A screening mammogram usually has the copay waived by the insurance company. The screening mammogram is assigned code Z12.31. And remember that the ICD-10 CM was expanded in fiscal year 20 to include new codes for unspecified overlapping lumps in the right and left breast. Plan your mammogram today. Colorectal cancer screening is another preventive treatment that should be considered as copay is waived by most payers. Updated guidelines by the American Cancer Society state that patients should begin screening at age 45. The rate of colorectal cancer has increased 51% among those younger than age 50 since 1994. Colorectal screening is the only preventive test that can prevent cancer by removing the precancerous lesions. Colorectal screening is coded as Z12.11. One last test is depression screening, Z13.31. There's a 3-minute test that can be used to detect depression by asking questions of common experiences for people who suffer from depression. After the test is completed, access to a mental health newsletter is provided. It is important to remember our elderly who need the gift of time, so remember to stop by and say hello. The youngsters in our life need the gift of being heard, so remember to hear what they are saying. The holidays can be very difficult on the young and the old. And with that, I will wish you all a happy holiday season and the happiest new year. Be kind out there, and back to you, Erica.
Lori, that was a great public service announcement. Thank you. And it was a nice holiday present for our listeners. That was Lori Johnson. Lori is a senior healthcare consultant for Revenue Cycle Solutions, LLC.
Now is the time for Reg Watch, featuring nationally recognized healthcare technology consultant Stanley Knockerson. So, Stanley, good morning. Hey, a lot of news is coming out of Washington these days. What do we need to know?
Good morning, Chuck, and everybody on the line. CMS continues to remake the Medicare program to improve quality and value for beneficiaries. Beginning of October, CMS issued a proposed rule to modernize and clarify the regulations that interpret the Medicare physician self-referral law, which is often called the Stark Law. This law prohibits a physician from making referrals for certain healthcare services payable by Medicare if the physician or an immediate family member has a financial relationship with the entity performing the service, meaning a physician cannot refer a patient to any entity with which he or she has a financial relationship. Now, this proposed rule creates a new permanent exception to the Stark Law for value-based arrangements. The proposed rule would permit physicians and other healthcare providers to design and enter into value-based arrangements without fear that legitimate activities to coordinate and improve the quality of care for patients and those that lower costs would violate the Stark Law. These exceptions would apply regardless of whether the arrangement relates to care furnished to people with Medicare or to other patients. CMS has also introduced a direct contracting model. Under this model, there will be three types of direct contracted entities with different characteristics and operational parameters. These three types are the standard entities, which are comprised of organizations that generally have experience serving Medicare fee-for-service beneficiaries who are aligned in an entity through voluntary alignments or claims-based alignment. These organizations may have previously participated in certain other models. Alternatively, these new organizations composed of existing Medicare fee-for-service providers and suppliers may be created in order to participate in this program. In either case, these clinicians participating in the organizations would have substantial experience serving Medicare fee-for-service beneficiaries. They've also created new entrant entities, which are comprised of organizations that have not traditionally provided services to a Medicare fee-for-service population and that will rely primarily on voluntarily aligning, at least in the first few performance years. And the high-needs population entities that serve Medicare beneficiaries with complex needs, including dually eligible beneficiaries who are aligned to the entity through voluntary alignment or claims-based alignment. These entities are expected to use a model of care designed to serve individuals with complex needs, such as those employed by the programs of all-inclusive care for the elderly, to coordinate care for their aligned beneficiaries. The payment model is that these entities will be required to have a capitated payment arrangement whereby CMS makes a capitated payment to the entity, which may be used to support population health. For example, by allowing the entity to enter into value-based payment arrangements with its participant providers, and if they elect it, to invest in healthcare management tools such as healthcare technologies. So again, CMS providing additional funds to help move into value-based care and the use of technology. Now, CMS also issued the Home Health Agency final rule for calendar year 2020. In this rule, CMS established a permanent home infusion therapy benefit to be implemented beginning in 2021. It also allows therapist assistants rather than only therapists to perform maintenance therapy under the Medicare home health benefit in accordance with individual state practice requirements. This is similar to the physician assistant provision that we talked about in the physician fee schedule rule. And it also implements the patient-driven groupings model, a new case mix, a payment methodology for home health services, which more accurately pays for home health services and focuses on patient needs by relying heavily on patient characteristics rather than the volume of care, and provides the rule also provides a 4% higher payment amount for these all these modifications for the initial year of this new payment model. Thanks very much, and Dr. Reamer, back to you.
Thank you, Stanley. That was Healthcare IT Authority Stanley Knockerson. Stanley is the founder of Knockerson Advisors, LLC. Chuck?
Thanks, Erica. Thank you again, Stanley. As we noted at the top of the broadcast, the holiday season isn't as quiet, as bright and merry for some folks. For them, it's a time of stress, anxiety, in some cases, depression. Here now with the prescription to ameliorate the holiday blues is Talk 10 Tuesday resident psychiatrist, Dr. H. Stephen Moffitt. Good morning, Dr. Moffitt.
Morning. And Chuck, thanks so much for Lori's careful presentation about the real ICD considerations and recommendations for the upcoming holidays. Take my upcoming ones with lots of grain of salt. In all seriousness, to start off, though, today, December 10th, is not only the annual International Human Rights Day, but as we speak, articles of presidential impeachment may be coming forth. Health is a crucial human right that so many don't have enough of. Just maybe, ICD-10 has been missing some important holiday conditions that warrant some seasonal codes, conditions that are concerned about the darkness that covers some humans in the season of holiday light. Let's see how I found them. In taking a pre-holiday ride from Milwaukee all over the world, side by side with Santa, I dressed as Elijah. I found a copy of the publication called Physician Practice in the waiting room of a physician in warm San Diego. It caught my eye because of the headline article, 15 ICD-10 codes for the holidays. So, to try to laugh to keep from crying, I took a few which I could adapt for today's purpose and added some others. Let's call them the 10 derangements. The code, U2, human fights. This is diagnosed when a Republican and Democrat disagree on the human right of Santa to bring presents to the homeless. Code, V80.1, injury as occupant of animal-drawn vehicle. Should an older man with a beard arrive on, say, December 24th Eve and injures his hip on landing, get him to the emergency room ASAP and hope he doesn't see a burned-out doctor. Code, T75.4, electric shock. No, we're not talking about electric shock treatment for worsening holiday blues that are becoming suicidal, but rather getting shocked from the careless mishandling of the Hanukkah or Christmas lights. Code Z72.820, sleep deprivation. This is common in parents staying up late preparing presents and in kids in their excitement of getting the presents, but the deprivation ends up making them irritable when they get the presents. Code Z72.891, sibling rivalry. In a dispute of who got the best presents and what should be given to charity, a family therapist is called in and is angry about being taken away from his family. Code X08.8, burned by candle. Those who are left-handed and discriminated against are prone to get burned in lighting the menorah candles as the eight Hanukkah nights progress. Code V06.00XA, collision with non-motor vehicle. Distracted by looking at a cell phone for holiday sales, your car collides with Santa's reindeer. Code, are you him? The false Santa sociopathy. Pretending to be Santa when you are really the Scrooge who takes all the presents that he thinks he deserves. Code, 0C25, light it up for the most outrageous and over-the-top Hanukkah lights. Code, TY11, talk 10, turkey. If you think about our Native Americans and human rights, it is hard to have Thanksgiving without feeling some guilt for how they have been treated. Now, we need your votes over which seasonal ICD codes to keep and treat. In the meanwhile, my prescription is, like a family therapist, we in healthcare should do whatever we can to help resolve conflict wherever it is. Over to you, Erica.
That was hysterical. Thank you. That was nationally prominent psychiatrist and author Dr. H. Stephen Moffitt. Chuck?
Thank you. Thanks, Dr. Moffitt, very much, and congratulations on your new book, Combating Physician Burnout. It's a guide for psychiatrists. And speaking of burnout, be sure to read my interview with Dr. Moffitt. It's in today's edition of the ICD-10 Monitor News. And coming up next, another holiday gift, this one from Susan Gatehouse. It's coming your way in 60 seconds. This is Talked In Tuesday. Stand by.
For 2020, you will need to know how to apply numerous CPT and HCPCS code changes, including lumbar puncture, iliac endograft placement, pericardial drainage, and other radiology procedures, both diagnostic and interventional, or risk payments and compliance. So don't miss the 2020 Radiology Coding Update webcast, presented by industry-leading expert Jeff Ezerzak. Jeff will provide in-depth guidance on all the changes, what they are, the impact to your facility, and how to apply them. Jeff Mazurzak will walk you through strategies to prevent miscoding and non-compliant billing. Don't miss this opportunity to maximize your radiology reimbursements and solidify your regulatory compliance through actionable, practical instruction. To register, click on the MedLearn Publishing tab on today's broadcast dashboard and save $25 by using the coupon code Tuesday at checkout.
In the holiday spirit of giving, here now is Susan Gatehouse with a holiday gift. It's a list of steps to take to avoid claim denial. Susan?
Thank you, Chuck, and happy holidays to all. I don't know that my segment is going to be as entertaining as Dr. Moffitt's, but I will certainly go over some high points here. In many ways, claims denials is an unavoidable reality in healthcare. Ineffective claims denial management results in loss of revenue. The industry average of denials is anywhere from 10% to 5% to 10%. Keeping the denial rate below 5% is often what healthcare organizations' goal is. Inpatient denials tend to stay in the forefront of healthcare, secondary to the dollars associated with each claim, which is certainly understandable. However, it is not uncommon for healthcare organizations to receive several hundred outpatient denials on a monthly basis. These often go overlooked. Although the dollar amount per claim basis may be low, the volume of outpatient services can drive up the denied amount into the millions, even within a one-month period. 60% of information on an outpatient claim is related to information gathered before the time of service. And the key word is before, so that would be related to, for example, pre-authorization, demographics, etc., leaving 40% up for grabs, so to speak, and this 40% is typically related to billing edits. Denials are deadline-driven, so the first order of business is to determine the initial point of contact within an organization, how the information is shared with the affected departments, and how communication occurs regarding the resolution of a denial. Once an organization responds to a denial, the process does not end. Follow-up is needed to ensure a claim is paid when appropriate. This first process inherently prompts the need for an outpatient denials committee. In addition to the aforementioned process, a few of the key areas for the committee to focus are as follows. Develop a strategy for addressing outpatient denials. And specifically what I mean by that is personnel for reviewing denials. Is it a clinical denial or a technical denial? Those two require very different skill sets. Is the denial related to the correction of charge master, revenue code, duplicate claims, a local coverage decision, medically unusual edits? Sometimes system-related issues do occur that result in a denial. Also, your CPT codes, the use of diagnosis codes, revenue codes, and the appropriate use of modifiers are often related to denials as well. And it's so very important to track those by payer. This can be quite helpful to determine which departments may need further education or what could be corrected on the front end of billing. For your top payers, know the payer language related to denials. For example, some payers do not allow certain standards of care. Payers have patterns. Authorization challenges, which will only become more arduous with the onset of appropriate use criteria, should be addressed. Remember, 60% of what's on a claim typically occurs prior to the patient being seen. There is a repetition with denials, so it's all about learning the patterns of denials and appeals and ultimately tracking payment. If there are claims that should be paid after an appeal and aren't, don't be apprehensive about contacting the payer. Not that it's an easy process, but certainly put forth the effort and note trends before doing so to ensure your efforts are well served. There's no question providers can recoup lost revenue through the claims appeal process. There's a direct correlation between clean claim submission and a reduction of denials post-billing. The ultimately decreases the payment cycle and lessens the burden of staff members. Claims are often reviewed prior to billing to ensure potential issues triggering edits are corrected prior to billing. This often is referred to as edit reconciliation. It's becoming common practice due to the advantages of the process. Taking preventative action to create clean claims and reduce the incidence of denied claims is essential for keeping cash flowing. Denied claims are far more expensive to process on average than the initial claim. Given that, an ounce of prevention is still worth at least a pound of cure. Back to you, Erica.
Thanks, Susan. That was Susan Gatehouse. Susan is the CEO of Axia Solutions.
Now is the time for our very popular segment here at Talk 10 Tuesday, and of course it features our very own Dr. Erica Reamer. Dr. Reamer, it's yours.
I also want to apologize for having prepared a serious talkback. I put it together in response to a comment by one of our listeners during a previous Talk 10 Tuesday. So when I pontificate about sepsis, people from the state where I grew up, if you can't tell from my accent, New York, tell me that they are not allowed to transition to sepsis 3 by state regulation. I reviewed section 405.4 to see exactly what the guidance is. Please read my expanded article in ICD-10 Monitor because there are direct quotes which hopefully won't get lost in the translation here. The regulation says all New York State licensed hospitals must have in place evidence-based protocols for the early identification and treatment of patients with severe sepsis and septic shock. The protocols are supposed to be based on, and I quote, generally accepted standards of care. They mandate a process for screening and early recognition of severe sepsis and septic shock, which requires treatment according to their established protocol, such as hemodynamic support and early antibiotic administration. Results of their initiative are publicly reported and are illuminating. They define sepsis as a life-threatening condition that requires early detection and timely, appropriate interventions to improve the chances of survival and optimize outcomes for patients of all ages, as well as a clinical syndrome in which patients have an infection that is accompanied by an extreme systemic response. Their definitions still list the sepsis 2 categories of sepsis, severe sepsis, and septic shock, but it is noted to be for data collection. Sepsis protocols are intended for severe sepsis and septic shock only, just like CMS SEP 1. In fact, they acknowledge that the alignment with CMS SEP 1 measure was intended to reduce measure abstraction burden for hospitals and to minimize the confusion resulting from discrepancy between New York State and CMS sepsis measures. Then they introduce confusion when they decide to use the word sepsis in the report to signify severe sepsis and septic shock. This will become even more complicated when the CDC adapts ICD-10-CM to only have codes for sepsis and septic shock in the near future. In fact, sepsis, which they still define as a confirmed or suspected infection accompanied by two, and I am directly quoting, system inflammatory response syndrome, or SIRS criteria, is not part of the protocol because it does not cross the threshold of severe sepsis or septic shock. New York and other conscientious objectors to sepsis 3 contend that not picking up early sepsis is going to result in increased mortality. I believe they are using early sepsis to indicate sepsis without organ dysfunction, only with deranged vital signs, perhaps. There is no category of, code for, or protocol to treat early sepsis. So I don't know how anyone can assess for this adverse outcome. Finally, the Sepsis Initiative Improvement Report noted that on November 14, 2018, the regulation was amended to clarify that sepsis definitions are for the purposes of hospital data collection and reporting and are not intended to direct clinical care. Sepsis is a clinical diagnosis, and clinicians should be permitted to make this diagnosis appropriately. There are no gold standard diagnostic criteria, not SIRS, not SOFA. Sepsis is life-threatening organ dysfunction due to dysregulated systemic host response to infection. That is, the condition formerly known as severe sepsis. It should be treated aggressively to try to prevent mortality. If you are concerned a patient is developing sepsis, treat it aggressively. If no organ dysfunction ensues, the patient never developed sepsis. Good for you and the patient. SIRS may be a harbinger of sepsis,
but it is not a defining characteristic nor diagnostic criteria. Acknowledge it, address it, but do not rely on it to make the diagnosis of sepsis, severe sepsis, or septic shock, whether you live in New York or not. So, from this ex-New Yorker to all of you, have very happy holidays and see you next year. Back to you, Chuck.
Thanks, Erica, very much. And that's going to be your wrap for our 397th edition of Talk 10 Tuesday. And I want to thank our panelists today, Susan Gatehouse, Lori Johnson, Dr. H. Stephen Moffitt, Stanley Noxon, Tim Powell, and, of course, our good host, Dr. Erica Reamer. This is our last broadcast for 2019. We will be back, though, on Tuesday, January the 14th. And as many of you know, we've been live broadcasting since May 2011. Of course, it takes a lot of dedicated folks to pull off this kind of a broadcast. And I want to thank our producer, Emily Anderson. And I want to thank also our live event producer, Laura Baker. And our special thanks to Angela Corniger. She's a MedLearn Media Executive Director and her great team of professionals. Until next year being 2020, we'll talk to you then. That's going to be January the 14th, 10 a.m. Eastern. I'm Chuck Buck reporting for IC Design Modern Talk 10 Tuesday. Thank you very much. Have a great holiday, everybody. Thanks again.
Talk 10 Tuesday is a production of ICD 10 Monitor.